Welcome to On the Mic. I am your host, Tim Drake. This is the first episode with the new name of the podcast being On the Mic. As some of you may know, we were formerly called In the Studio. We ended up having a few issues within the studio, so we revamped some things, renamed the show, and now you have On the Mic. So we're thrilled to have you guys along with us. I've been watching the numbers continually grow and could not be more thrilled. So thank you so much for all of you out there listening. I really appreciate all the support. In today's episode, I sat down with award-winning writer, director, producer, Glenn Simister. I got to know Glenn a few years back when I was actually in one of his movies that he was shooting. Just as an extra, just a featured extra. But, you know, it was a good time. Got to know Glenn. And we met up at the Hollywood and Highland Center. Right there off of Hollywood Boulevard. Same place they hold the Oscars. And we sat down, chatted about filmmaking, what inspires Glenn, what got him started. And we really had a good time just kind of catching up, shooting the breeze. And yeah, it was a good time. So I hope you guys really enjoy the show. Make sure to follow On the Mic on Twitter, as well as Facebook, and visit the website. So check out this interview with Glenn Simister. How are you doing today, Glenn?
I'm doing pretty terrific now that I have coffee in me.
So. It's always a good way to start the morning. It's still pretty early here.
Yeah, it is.
So today we're doing a podcast at the Hollywood and Highland Center. So right off of Hollywood Boulevard. Still got a little bit of the marine layer over, so it's not all nice and sunny yet.
Yeah, I've only been here 2 months. Haven't been here yet. It's pretty uptight. I like it.
I've got nice palm trees out to the side of us. It's not a bad view right now. Just around the corner, we got the Hollywood sign facing us. It's a good place to be.
Yeah, right in the heart of it all.
Literally the heart of it all. Yeah. I mean, we're a stone throw from the Dolby Theater where the Oscars are held.
Yeah.
So have you ever come out here for that?
I have not, no. So I'll definitely be like stalking this place come Oscar time.
It's incredible. So like Jordan and I came out last year.
Oh, did you?
For some of the festivities and stuff, and it was mind-blowing.
Wow.
So, and then my wife and I had come out the year before, and it is just crazy.
Yeah.
To watch, I mean, how all of Hollywood Boulevard just shut down for the red carpet. And,
wow.
It's definitely something you're going to have to soak in now.
Yeah, if you're a fan of movies, it's kind of the place to be at that time.
Yeah. Now, Glenn, you moved out from Salt Lake, from where we are all from. Well, we as in our show originated from. About a month and a half before I did. So what was it that really brought you out to California? Most importantly, to Hollywood.
Well, the biggest thing is my girlfriend. I mean, I would have been out here several years ago if it weren't for her. But she is a philosopher, and she got accepted to the grad program at UCLA. And so she's basically just, like, paid to come out here and go to school. And so, like, she had a few options, but this place is film center, so it's good for me, it's good for her, she loves the school, so it's kind of just the right time and place for both of us to come out, so we did.
Right on.
Yeah.
So now before coming out here, you've written, produced, and directed 6 different short films.
Yeah, I did.
Right, and you've won multiple awards for those as well.
I have.
So what initially got you interested in doing film?
I mean, that came really, really early. I mean, I was 6 years old, and like ever since I went into the theater and saw Jurassic Park, that was the film that like I actually stepped into a theater and like stepped into another world and actually found out there's like this art and stuff. And ever since then, just ever since a really young age, I was hooked ever since then. And then when I was about 14, I started writing film scripts. So I've been actually writing them for like 12 years now, almost nonstop. Yeah, since then. And then, yeah, finally I saved up for a year after high school and I went to Salt Lake Community College, mainly because, like, I've heard, you know, they're really hands-on there. They're actually better than the U in some regards. Like, there tend to be a lot more of theory at the U of U as opposed to Salt Lake Community College. So I was able to go there. I actually spent 6 years there because I did a production one class. I'm like, you know, I'm not ready to be a filmmaker yet. I just felt it in my bones, you know. So I spent, you know, additional years before I even went through the film program to just work on my writing, work on photography especially. And so that kind of led me to there, and then right out of the gate of getting my degree and as a film technician, I just created a few more films on my own and was able to win some awards through there and learned a lot.
And that's actually how I first got to know you, was through your film The Apogee.
Yep. Yeah, you came as an extra.
Yeah, I was an extra in that, and that was kind of right as I had even started doing anything in film.
Yeah.
Was the agent I had at the time, within a week of joining that agency, sent this over and was just like, hey, this would be good, you know, get in with, you know, a young director writer that's, you know, already won some awards, and was just kind of like, okay, yeah, may as well go from there. So yeah. And it was a great film. It was a really cool film to be a part of.
Yeah.
So now, you mentioned Jurassic Park.
It was
the first one that you really got involved with. And it's funny every time I hear somebody say that, because I think that was, at least for me, what really kind of got me going, even to the point that I wanted to be in the next one so bad.
Right, yeah. Like, that was the dream.
Yeah, it was the dream. It was dinosaurs. Who the hell wouldn't want to be part of that? And I remember I sent a letter to Steven Spielberg.
Wow. Oh.
And my dad intercepted the letter before it went anywhere.
Really?
And so he wrote me back as Steven Spielberg.
Wow.
Saying that, hey, they were going to bring auditions to Utah, and they were going to be at the Fashion Place Mall, but they were looking for the part of caveman, and I had to go in a loincloth.
Oh my gosh.
And he thought immediately, like, I'd be like, nope, not happening. But he was wrong, because I was like, cool, let's do it. You know, can we make sure we go there? My dad was like, you know what a loincloth is, right? I was like, yep, let's go. And I think that's when it kind of troubled my parents, that I would pretty much do anything to
be in the film.
To be in the film industry.
Right.
More or less just entertainment in general.
Yeah. Wow, that's like both evil and very sweet and endearing of your father.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, Jurassic Park, I think a lot of filmmakers around our age, that was really one that...
Yeah, I mean, so easily captured your imagination. Like, no one's ever seen anything like that before, and like, plus it's dinosaurs, so anyone that was like under the age of 12 is instantly captivated by it. So yeah, I mean, it touched a lot of people in ways you can't even really formulate in words.
And I think that's, you know, it's funny because you hear a lot of directors and producers that it's been Spielberg and Lucas that have, it's always been their films that have captivated them to really, really want to make film.
Right.
So, I mean, I think it's interesting that, I mean, you go through the generation gaps, and it's like our generation, yeah, we saw Jurassic Park and we were hooked, but you hear some of those others that they saw Jaws and they were set.
Yeah, there's a kind of a generational gap, like Spielberg and George Lucas, they kind of went off the old special effects of, like, you know, the King Kongs, and that's what inspired them.
Yeah.
King Kongs and, like, old Godzillas, I don't know, stuff like that. And then there was a generation, as you say, like Jaws and E.T. and Close Encounters, which are all, like, very Spielberg and Lucas-centric, and then, you know, Star Wars as well. That started a whole bunch of people, too. So, yeah, there's always the film that kind of jump-starts an artist, and always starts at a really early age, gets in there, and it never leaves your brain. So that kind of sets the course for your rest of your life, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, it did. And I personally wanted to try to take the whole Spielberg route of going on one of those studio tours and then just trying to step off the tour tram and go set up my own office.
It's very hard now.
Yeah, unfortunately, security is a lot tighter now.
Yeah.
So just as I went on the Warner lot the other day, I had my security pass and everything to walk on the lot, and they still needed to see, like, my, like, two different forms of ID. I'm like, I have it right. Like, I had to show you guys ID just to get the pass.
Oh, my gosh.
And she's like, man, those were the days when you could just step off a tram and go set up your own office.
Yeah, the heyday where you just, like, sneak in and, like, they don't even bug a kid. Yeah, it's a tougher business and everything. It's writing, directing, even getting in on just a film crew. It's pretty tough.
Yeah, it's definitely become, and I think, you see a lot of the real successful filmmakers now, you know, they've just kind of gotten to the point where they're just kind of like, you know, screw it, if I can't get in on it, I'm going to make it on my own and, you know, bring it to me that way.
Yeah.
So there was actually one filmmaker I just had the opportunity to meet this last week. He'd won the Nickel Fellowship through the Academy, won a Student Academy Award, and it was all just because he was just kind of like,
all right, well, I'm just doing this, and it's like, now all of a sudden he's Oscar bait.
Yeah.
And it's just crazy that to really see it go that way. And I think even like with Danny McBride and Seth Rogen and some of those guys, that was really how they kind of had to even really make that push.
Yeah.
To get their films out there.
Yeah, they just had to see someone behind them had to see like an opportunity, and they caught them all like wildfire. And so, yeah, you either make it or you just completely break it.
Now, what was the first film you ever attempted to make? Because like I said, you've done 6 short films so far here. What was the first one that you did make?
I don't know. I guess the first one I tried to take seriously, I actually made in high school. It's called Beast of Burden. I did it with just a friend of mine. I don't know. Like, I was really, that was when I was first writing scripts, and I was really just excited and trying to be collaborative in the film process. So we like did an all-nighter playing video games and wrote the script and then shot it the next weekend. It was about a stuffed bird that came alive and just terrorized these 2 kids. And we were really influenced by Edgar Wright's Shaun of the Dead at the time. And so it went in, you know, even as far as I was like talking a little, had like a British accent, and it was very Shaun of the Dead-esque. And I don't know, it turned out okay, you know, considering what we had. And so, yeah, that was the first one I tried to actually implement a whole bunch of cinematic verite and, you know, a whole bunch of crazy camera angles and actually trying to get good audio on something and trying to actually say something with imagery. So, yeah, I mean, that kind of started a little early in life. I think I was about sophomore year.
Wow, so do you still have copies of that like you put up on YouTube or anything? Is like your...
You know what? Yeah, it is on YouTube. It's called Beast of Burden, and it's that's like, it's really weird seeing me in that because that's when I used to be like a, you know, bigger kid before I like lost all my weight, and so like that's kind of like me then, and it's, I don't know, it's incredibly awkward and embarrassing, but I like it because you kind of see the start of it all, the descent of kind of like my rise into film.
It's the past life, Glenn.
Yeah, definitely. It's way different, Glenn. So, and I have a really bad British accent, so
that's cool.
It's worth watching, I guess, if you're drunk.
I always think it's funny when I hear any entertainer say, you know, in my past life when I was heavier, because I look at mine in my past life, I was the skinnier. Like you look all of like my music and stuff like that, and it's like, how did I suddenly like? I went like the inverse way that all the entertainers went.
Yeah, it just happens. It always happens quick, and then that suddenly there is this division between the 2 people. And
I think I've mentioned it before on our show where Chris Hardwick, that is Nerdist, always refers to his past self when he was a bigger guy as Peter Hardwick. So he completely separates. No, my past guy was Peter Hardwick. It was his evil brother. I think he's always
put. Oh, wow. Yeah, sometimes it does feel like just so much different that you just have to like say, yeah, that's kind of like a brother. So that's perfect.
I can say the perfect diet plan though is moving out to Hollywood.
Oh man, when we had to move, I was busting ass for like 3 days straight. I must have burned like 10,000 calories, and I didn't feel like eating because I was like, I'm out here. Like, what the hell am I gonna do? Like, it was such a big shock. Like, I love Salt Lake City so much, and so when I moved out here, I was like even kind of depressed for 3 days, so I couldn't eat, and I was just hauling boxes up and down 3 flights of stairs. It's a great yeah. Workout regimen.
I mean, it's got to the point, I know at least for me, where it's like you're constantly, you know, working and trying to find more work.
Yeah
So, and it becomes the fact that you're just so busy,
right,
that like my wife just last night was like, what have you eaten today? And I was just like, I think I had a sandwich around like 9.
Yeah.
And this was at about 10 o'clock last night after Breaking Bad was over.
What did it rule, by the way?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good.
Oh, yeah. It was pretty epic. It was everything I was hoping it would be.
Nice. Yeah, I just started season 5, so there's that. But yeah, like, I digress a little bit. But yeah, I'm always up at 4 a.m., and I just have like a mango and banana, and that's it. And I'm actually sending inquiry letters for not only like my scripts, but like a novel right now as well. So I'm sending those from about like 5 a.m. to about 9, and then I do about three or four hours of script writing, and then about 2 hours of, you know, whatever writing. And then I'm back to searching for, like, another kind of menial job, which I still have a hard time. So even though I haven't worked for 2 months, I've actually never worked harder in my life.
Right.
It's insane.
Yeah, it's like the finding the job and then trying to make that job becomes full-time jobs in and of themselves.
Yeah, yeah, they really are. It's...
And especially the script writing process.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, that's... it can be so, you know, just mind-wrenching. As you're trying to go through... I mean, there's one that I was working on just the other night that I probably wrote about 6 pages and then just look back through and I was like, that's all crap.
Yeah, I mean, that... Like,
it's like
you
spend all that time
to,
and just...
Yeah, I mean, like, he just kind of... It's called, like, the vomit draft, I think is what they kind of colloquially call it. But, yeah, like... Usually, I'll kind of outline a story really well, and it'll kind of invade my mind for, like, you know, however long it takes, so to the point where I can't even sleep at night. I'm just thinking about plot details and how are these characters going to work out this and that. And then you write out the 120 pages, and about 90% of it is total shit. So, like, you know, it's kind of, as they say, 80% of the work is actually editing.
Yeah.
That's really true. That's the hardest thing about writing. It's like once you've written it, you're like, oh, okay, the journey on that script has actually just begun.
Yeah. Yeah. With the TV pilot that Jordan and I just had recently finished, it's like, I mean, we knew where the story was going for months. Mm-hmm. And it's like we finished the pilot and then went through and spent like another month and a half editing. And to the point that we were happy with it, we actually sent it right to the producers of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
So, never heard anything back. So, and it's like, we were able to send it out to a few different people. And then I sent it to one of my buddies that's been getting mentored by just tons of different, like, major showrunners and stuff. And he went through and just beyond dissected it. Really? And, it was crazy because it was some of the things that Jordan and I had talked about of, oh, are we going to change this? Should we do this? Is this a problem? And it was kind of like, we knew what was wrong, but at the same time, we didn't want to say, oh, that's, you know, there's any problem there. Like, we liked what we had, and then he just opened it all up, and was like, all right, we basically get to start all over.
Yeah.
But it was in a good way. I think he was kind of nervous to be like, yeah, you guys should probably rewrite the entire thing, but it was good. It was.
Yeah, I mean, you need to be beaten down with your scripts so harshly. Like, you're only really as good as, like, the best editors or like the ones who give you the best constructive criticism.
Yeah.
It's so sorely needed. I don't even know where I'd be without my girlfriend. She's the most harsh editor I've ever had in my life. She'll just like, she'll take a script, she'll thumb through it. She'll be like, this is shit. What are you doing? Like, what are you doing? She'll just yell at me and yell at me. I'm like, I'm sorry. But then like, I come out with a way better script and I love her more for it. So it's just like, you have to be really harsh because you have to create a lot of, you have to, like, trowel through a lot of shit in order to get through the good goal.
Yeah, definitely.
So.
And I think that's even, like, with film editing, I think that's where it really comes down to, where I didn't really learn that until probably the second short film that we had done.
Oh, yeah.
Where, like, I had come up with my edit of it, and I wasn't very fond of it, but I was just like, eh, it is what it is. And one of the other guys that was working on it with us is just an editing genius.
Oh, good. Yeah.
And he gave me his cut, and it was just like, holy shit, like, he actually made the movie what it was.
Yeah, it's amazing how many cadences one film can have just through different editing beats.
And it's like, I had directed the entire thing and knew where, like, I had done a bunch of extra shots that weren't even in, like, necessarily related to the script, because I was like, we can throw those in here and there, and he actually used those, so it was like, I kind of was like, hey, all right, we used things that weren't even planned on.
Nice.
But he used them to such perfection that it was just like, it was kind of that reality to me of where editing just plays such a key role.
It is, yeah. Like, it's amazing how a film takes on its own life in the editing stage. Like, you bring it in the editing bay, you think it's going somewhere, you think you know where you want it to go, and then you actually find out the film might actually want to go a different direction than you want. So you have to, like, let it breathe. Some editors that can kind of get into the rhythm of editing. That's something I'm still trying to work on, but some people just intrinsically have it where they can just understand the breadth of a film and where it wants to go.
Definitely. And I think one of the things that I've at least noticed that I think has at least helped me grow as an editor, and I'm sure, you know, you can speak to this as well, is just watching a lot of films in the genre that you're writing.
Yeah. Oh, man. So helpful. Yeah. I mean, you kind of have to. Otherwise, you're just kind of shooting in the dark around a whole bunch of places.
Yeah.
So you got to kind of know what the audience already expects. And then once you know what is kind of expected, then you can actually let it grow. And that's where, like, some true art can come out of. But you need to intrinsically know, like, what's already been done.
Yeah, like with our TV show, as I've been, you know, rewriting this now and kind of trying to redevelop certain bits and pieces of it, like, I started watching The League.
Uh-huh.
The, I mean, that show is just fucking hilarious.
Really?
So, I mean, it's just, it's so, you know, so many guys like that, but at the same time, it's just so out there with certain things.
Yeah.
And, like, that show's been great, and then I had so many people that were like, you need to start watching Workaholics. And I was like, alright, whatever, I'll start watching. And it's like, that show's just been fantastic. And all of a sudden, like, it opened up where I was looking at bits and pieces of our script, and I was like, oh yeah, that's trash. Like, uh-huh. Why the hell did we write that? Like, and I think that, yeah, watching those shows in those genres, and I think, in a way, a lot of people are scared.
Mm, yeah.
To do that, because you don't want to rip off what somebody else has done.
Yeah, there's a fine line between, like, an homage or, you know, just plain ripping off. But as long as the writer has their own voice,
yeah,
it'll guide them straight. I mean, everything, you want to have some sort of reverential ideal to every kind of genre you're in. But, yeah, as long as you're not ripping word for word and you're a good writer, a good solid writer, you'll be fine.
I think probably one of my favorite things that we've noticed is, like, right before my wife and I moved out here, we'd boxed up so much, and, like, we didn't have a lot of things to watch when we were at home. So I was like, I'm just going to keep all my seasons of The Simpsons out.
Yeah, yeah.
And we'll just, and there were lines on there that I was like, I pretty much wrote that same line, not even realizing. I was like, that makes me feel good as a writer if I'm on the, like, I'm thinking of similar lines that Simpsons writers were. It's like, then again, I live off of The Simpsons, so maybe that line was somewhere in the back of my brain.
Called the phantom subconsciousness. Yeah, it kind of comes out. It's amazing what can stick in your mind and you don't even realize it.
So now with your other short films, after you did that one as a sophomore, what was, yep, the next one that you kind of did from there?
I did a sequel to that, Beast of Burden 2. Okay. And it was a shittier film, but technically it was superior. So, like, I learned more about, you know, camera works and audio in that one more than anything. But then jumping in after that, I waited for a long time. And then I finally did my first production in film. So it was like 2 years after I started college. I'm like, okay, I'm good enough to go in and start writing and directing stuff. So I directed, like, this really short film called Jumpstart. It was basically how the scientist was working on a brain that was, like, dead, but he was, like, shooting electrodes through it. And so the audience was actually shown, as the electrodes are going through the brain, what this kid's life was. You know, it's kind of like just shooting off memories, and it was really bad. But, you know, you have to make a lot of bad stuff.
Yeah.
And so I didn't mind it that much, but it had some good qualities. So, you know, that was me just kind of exploring, like, how the audience sees the dichotomy between the now and, like, probably flashbacks. That was me just filling that out. So that was the next project after.
So Jumpstart was really the first one you did as a college student then.
Yeah. And then after, like, kind of going through the drudgery of, like, all the actual college stuff, then I did The Apogee, which was about wine, which was completely independent. And then I did another film after that, most recently. It's called Little Moon. Yeah, that was a rough film to do, but it came out so well, and it's actually, I'm waiting to hear on a few film festivals right now.
Nice.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's going to be out there pretty soon, and everyone's really pleased with it. Has, like, imagination. It's kind of like Where the Wild Things Are meets, like, Fantastic Voyage in space, you know.
Oh, wow.
It's, yeah, no, it's fun. It's a good one. So those are the most recent ones. It's The Apogee and Little Moon.
Now, speaking of film festivals, you've had your film shown at the Buffalo Niagara Film Festival.
Uh-huh.
Solid Community College Film Festival. X96 Film Festival.
Yep.
You've been part of the Channel 801 series.
Uh-huh.
Actually, one of our prior guests, Jamie Maxfield, is the one that I know puts that together.
Yeah.
So Jamie,
cool guy.
I think if you actually go back in that episode, we actually mentioned you in that.
Really?
Both you and Steve Green. So, we were asking, we're like, have you seen, you know, Glenn's or Steve's stuff? Like, they're great, you know, for local film.
Oh, wow, yeah.
So, and yeah, so we actually did mention you guys in that.
Oh, that's cool.
In that episode, you'll have to go back and find that one.
I will, Jamie. He's a really good guy.
And then this last year, too, you were under consideration with one of your films for Sundance. Is that right?
Yeah, I submitted. I mean, it's really, the Apogee, even though everyone's really liked it so far, it's actually had a really hard time getting into film festivals. We're in a day and age where, you know, like, it's hard to sit down for 3 minutes and watch a YouTube video now. And so even people that go to a film festival, they don't really want to see a 26 minute film, you know. Mm-hmm. It's really more of a featurette more than a short film. And so even like film festivals like the Napa Film Festival, which I tried to get into, they don't want to take it because all their short film entries, they're 5 minutes or less. A couple of them have been 10 minutes. So, you know, it's really hard getting a featurette instead of a short film.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm actually kind of playing around with trying to shorten the film down to 15 or 10 minutes just to get it more exposure. Because, the actors, everyone in that involved was terrific. It's, you know, it's a film I really want to see, people to see, actually. I actually just adapted it. I've actually pitched it to a couple of producers and agencies, and they actually seem to like it. I'm just waiting to hear back from them on it, probably this week. But anyway, I turned it into a feature film, and the script is really, you know, it's pretty solid. It's a young script, but it has a lot of potential. And so just the concept kind of drives people in. So hopefully I can get something going on, because it was always meant to be a bigger, wider feature film. So it'll just have more breath now. So hopefully that
happens. Now, do you still have that up on YouTube for people to view?
I actually don't. Like, I need to kind of split it up onto two different parts to go on Vimeo. That's why I've always been reluctant about putting it on the web, because then people like watch a few minutes of the first part and then they don't finish the second part.
Right.
So I mainly just have a trailer up on Vimeo. But if anyone ever needed to see it, I just shoot them a DVD. It's pretty cheap. So I just like people seeing it. So it'll be on the web, especially once I hear back from a few more festivals. Because I like festivals too. They like to have kind of exclusivity with it. They don't like it to be on the web, so it's easier to get in if it's not.
Right.
So yeah, that's kind of where that stands.
Now you mentioned some of the producers and stuff that you kind of pitched to.
Yeah.
Now this last weekend you were pitching to the Weinstein Company.
I did.
And Legendary, is that right?
Yeah, Legendary. Also, you know, I actually kind of made the rounds with a whole bunch of others, too. It was kind of like this pitch fest that I was able to get into. I talked to them. I don't know how well that went, because I was pitching a new film that I'm just, like, treatmenting right now. It's based on a true life of William Beaumont. He was, like, this doctor who worked on a patient with a fistula in his stomach. And it's never been really told, so I've been pitching that idea, and I just started writing it. Even though it's an historical film, it's kind of hard for people to get into the groove. So I don't know how much, headway I'll make with those guys. So it's really more along the lines of hearing about the scripts I've already worked with and have completed that agencies have right now. So they're just kind of considering me to kind of shop those scripts around. My best kind of option right now is just to get in with a manager agency so they can get me rewrite jobs. So as long as that happens, I'll be writing in the industry, and then, you know, maybe a few years down the line, my scripts will sell. It's a really hard industry right now for screenwriters. Spec scripts don't sell,
right?
Typically. I think about, as of to date, only about 38 spec scripts have sold this year, which is a better upswing than the last 3 years already. It's really, you just kind of use them as a template to say, hey, I can write this genre, or, you know, I can write a screenplay in general. So, you know, they have to be really awesome scripts, but man, they don't sell.
Yeah, I had actually just barely watched a documentary on screenwriting.
Oh, is it Tales from the Script?
Yes.
Yes. Good one.
Yeah, and that, yeah, it's a fantastic one. And it's kind of an eye-opener.
It is.
And at the same time, I think with a lot of those, it's like it's either going to scare away the people that don't have what it takes, mm-hmm. or it's going to motivate those that it pushes you in the right direction.
Yeah.
It kind of gives you that, okay, this is what needs to happen. So, and I know for me, with one of the scripts that I'm working on right now, that's what it definitely did for me.
Yep.
It was like, okay, I see, you know, kind of what they're saying. You know, a lot of the studio's just going to go, eh.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, it definitely, it's an eye-opener to how hard it really is.
Yeah, it is.
To get scripts out there.
Yeah, it is. I mean, once you make it, too, maybe you sell something, or maybe you just get, like, a couple of rewrite jobs, then you need to sustain it. That's
yeah.
the biggest thing, too, like, you need to be known as, you know, this kind of writer that can work on this kind of project. You need to be constantly connecting with people and making sure that, you know, it's not just a 2-year fling, that you can sustain your writers for, you know, however long. There's these two really great screenwriters, Craig Mazin and John August. And they do a really awesome podcast. I don't know if you've
yeah.
heard of it, Script Notes. And they always talk about, even though they're really well known in the industry, you know, they're wondering if their careers are going to last more than 10 or 15 years. Kind of scary. But, you know, as long as you make a lot of money in it, you can kind of become a writer, well established, and then maybe you can, as I kind of plan on doing, transitioning back into directing. So.
Now, John August, though, he's won one or two Oscars.
Oh, man, I think two.
Yeah, so I think his career is pretty well
established
for him.
I think
him.
He'll be okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, for anyone else, I mean, I'd say 90% of screenwriters out there are just ghosts, you know. A lot of them, it's really common for it, even big Hollywood scripts with just like one writer. They'll do like 1 or 2 week sessions with 5 to 10 other writers just doing script doctoring.
Right.
And those writers, you know, you could have a full career, you know, years and years of just script doctoring and never get a credit ever.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think if I ended up in a position like that, I'd be perfectly fine because I would still
yeah,
be
you're
like...
still in the industry. You're still getting the paycheck.
Yeah, I'm getting, most importantly, just a hand and I'm pushing film forward in some way. It doesn't matter. Like, I don't care much about credits or anything. It's just, you know, I want to be, in, you know, in my own way, inspiring kids just like me to create and push film forward, and 10, 15 years down the line when they see a really awesome movie, you know, it's cool knowing you're a part of that and you're kind of advancing the art of filmmaking in a strange way. It's kind of a way of living past your own life. So that's kind of what I want to do, even if it's not credited. That's why screenwriting's so appealing. Plus, I love writing films. It's just kind of fits me right.
Yeah, and it's fun to watch. You know, in a way, the Neurosis is like your brain come to life on the screen.
Yeah, it's cool, like, especially when it's on screen, but even, like, on a page, it's like, wow, it's like my brain just, like, splayed out there, like paint. It's kind of, no, it's really interesting.
Yeah, and it's always fun to watch the audience reaction to it as well.
Yeah, man, there's nothing better than sitting down with your film with an audience and people are laughing at the jokes you made. It's, oh, man, it's kind of just magical. It's one of the best feelings. It's like one of the better feelings I've ever had in my life.
Yeah.
Is having people laugh at, especially the Apogee. There's like some really esoteric wine jokes, but people are still there just chuckling. It's great.
Yeah, and it, like I know when we did the Narcissist last year.
Yeah.
I mean, it was terrible. Like we hated it.
Yeah.
But I mean, it just kind of had to be done. I don't think we have it up anywhere to be seen because it was just
oh yeah
so terrible. But yet when it was shown, like. People were still laughing at it, and like I was just kind of hanging my head in shame of the entire thing. But
there.
Then, like, to still hear people laughing and enjoying it, part of my mind I was going, "Why are you laughing? Like, it's so bad." But I think that just comes from us being our own worst critic.
Oh yeah, big time.
So and I mean, on the very first one that we did called Personal Growth, that was just all about getting fat eating McDonald's. I mean that one. Got great laughs, and it's just beyond stupid. I mean, it's a minute and a half long.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just so stupid, but yet, for some reason, it got laughs, and it's like, that made me feel good, because it's like I was making fun of me being fat. And it
connects to people.
Yeah.
I mean, it resonates. Like, when people laugh, they, you know, they don't understand, like, the plight of the characters on screen, but they understand the plight that you put out there.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's like, it's this great universal connection.
I think, too, some people probably looked at it and was like, okay, he's okay with laughing at himself being fat. Now we can laugh at him.
Yeah, kind of that too. Like, it's kind of this social barrier breakdown.
So now a couple of the other films that you've done, I've had a little bit of curiosity.
Sure.
On kind of what they were. You had one that was called God Hates Me.
God, oh, yeah, what a cool film. Okay. Cool concept, bad film. That's like the film everyone kind of comes to me, and they're like, okay, even though I had some great actors in it, a couple spots were, like, pretty bad, because I couldn't really direct. We had, like, film crew of 2 to 3 people every night. I was just so surmounted by all the troubles of the world in my life at that point. It was just, even the last night of filming, my dog died.
Oh, jeez.
And, like, it was really, like, my mother was actually going to go put that's when I was living at home and we were actually filming in my house. And it was the last night of filming and that dog was just ridden with cancer.
Oh,
and
no.
Like, it was just like, it couldn't go on any longer. So my mom was literally putting the dog down as I was holding it together, like filming this movie. And like, oh yeah, it was just like the whole filming process was very rough. But it was a great film to do just cause it was working with a great concept, even if I couldn't, bring about the film in a great way, you know, like, lack of funding, lack of crew, didn't get a lot of time with my actors to really go through the scenes. We had Eric McGraw, who's actually also co-starred in The Apogee, mm-hmm. and that's where I met him. Man, fantastic actor, and he played God, and he was just like the most perfect God ever, you know, exactly as I wrote God, kind of this like really blithe kind of paragon of God. So, but yeah, no, it was, that's the one film everyone goes back to me like, that's a great concept. You should try to pitch that as a feature film. So I kind of want to revisit it, but at the same time, like, I filmed it, it's out there, and even though it's not this perfect thing that I even really have an interest in showing everyone, it's kind of already out there and created, so in a strange way, it lives on. So.
Now, as far as screenwriting's gone for, you've studied with a few, you know, pretty well-known screenwriters, at least in Salt Lake.
Yeah.
You had Jeffrey Gold and then Richard Dutcher.
Yeah.
So now Richard, Richard just blows my mind altogether with the level that he's at. You know, right now, I mean, a lot of people in Utah are going to hear Richard Dutcher and they're simply just going to think of, like, God's Army and Brigham City, and that's going to be where it ends for them, where Richard's done so much more beyond that.
Yeah, he even did, like, kind of a B-movie horror film he's still trying to get distribution on, so, like, which is interesting. So he kind of just does whatever he wants to do, and, you know, it definitely carries some sort of envy with me with that, because he's just making movies in Salt Lake whenever he kind of wants to, and he's able to, you know, get financing for him, and he has kind of free reign over his projects. It's kind of a beautiful thing.
And now, were you part of Project 23 that he did?
I was not. No, I didn't even really hear about it. I was actually, like, wrapping up The Apogee and stuff. And so when he kind of formulated that and started his new film, Boys at the Bar, I was kind of just out of everyone else's kind of sleeves because I was so wrapped up in this. So, or, yeah, he, like, I think that's where Steve Green kind of met up with them. And,
yeah, no, yeah, I do know Steve was part of it. I really wanted to do it.
Yeah.
But it was just, I didn't have the money.
Right, yeah.
So, I mean,
yeah,
I can't remember how much it was. I just remember I saw it, and I was like, oh, I want to do that. Oh, I don't have money.
Right.
Like, it was one of those kind of depressing moments where it was like, I could see what he was getting ready to put together, and I wanted to be part of it.
Yeah, it was really cool. I mean, I'm not sure about the final result. I haven't really seen much of it, but it was cool they got together and pulled all that off.
I think it's supposed to release next year.
Next year?
Yeah, I know they just barely did a big Kickstarter for it to raise the last of funding for editing and everything.
Yeah, I helped out with that, so it'll be interesting. Hopefully it turns out well for him.
So what did Richard and Jeff bring to the table for you as far as screenwriting?
Jeffrey Gold, when I worked with him a little bit, that's when I was kind of moving past, like, I finished one really bad feature screenplay and I had literally 10 others I was halfway through. It's kind of that point in writing where it's like getting through the second act. And so just talking movies with him, it was actually in a, you know, like a class setting, we would just watch like the first 10 minutes of films and see how like structured screenwriting is in like act two. And I don't know. So it was just a, it was just kind of like a mentor to kind of guide me, like, okay, this is how you transition and finish a script. That's kind of what I learned from him. But I mean, most of screenwriting is just kind of figuring out by yourself. Like, you have to make a lot of bad scripts and it eventually turns good. You read a lot of scripts and it eventually turns better as well. And then Richard Dutcher actually did, he did a screenwriting workshop over the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I, yeah, you had to pay a little bit to get into that too. Even though I, you know, I learned a lot, but I also didn't learn a lot at the same time, because he mainly went over a lot of things that I already have been trying to implement the last 10 years before that or whatever. But it was mainly great because it was just you and a group of 15, 20 other writers, and you were all reading each other's scripts. And this kind of fantastic thing happens when you actually read out your script. Not only do you notice like all the more typos, but you, you know, you notice a rhythm, you notice how characters are working or how they're not working. And so I kind of, that's where I really started realizing like, hey, not only do you need to be reading your scripts with people, but there's also like this hidden structure underneath it all. And it's mainly just comes out of feedback. And so it really just, it beats you down because you realize how what you're writing is not that great, which is great because it makes you more humble and, you know, you only come out of a better writer for it. So it's really just soaking in how bad of a writer you are in order to advance yourself. You have to be broken before you can grow.
And that, I know I really want to get involved with something like that, because it's like with one of the first scripts that I did it within a group, with reading, is one that Jordan kind of had the idea to do a film about a guy who just has crappy karma. And so I started developing the synopsis and everything for it, and I've been building the script for a film called Karmageddon that it's just about done, just about two guys that are just total douchebags, and all the shit comes back to them all in one day.
Yeah.
And so like as I started writing the script for it, like I'd done the first act, and it's a little morbid on parts, but I mean it's a full out comedy. And so like I bring it to the first screenwriting group and they read it and everybody just it's great. And I was like, no, it's not. Like,
yeah, there's some people that won't like
give me some shit, fling it at me. Like I can take it. I don't expect, I mean, Jordan and I've already started like any type of rejection letter that we get or harsh criticism, we print it out and we file it.
Yeah.
Because we want that reality.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we don't want to sit back and have the yes men telling us how great something was.
Right.
When we know in all honesty that it's, you know, it's beginning stuff. Like it's just the frame. Like it still needs the meat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, whenever I expect feedback from people, it's, you know, it's cool. I like it when people say, okay, yeah, this does work. This is funny. This does work. It's, you know, it's great stuff. But I mean, I expect 80% of it to be like scathing, like, the hell are you doing here? Why are you writing? you know, just like really beat you down. Like they need to kind of really chastise you for every typo.
Yeah.
Just make you feel horrible about yourself. And like, that's where real shit happens after that.
Yeah. I mean, if you get depressed enough, that's where the classics come from, is from pure depression.
Oh, I mean, yeah. Like some of the best stuff I've ever written is like during some of the most existentially angst moments of my life. You have to write. Being a writer is a really lonely and just horrible experience. I mean, you're crept up alone and you're with your own feelings. And oh yeah, no, you see some shit about yourself when you're just like really depressed, but then the writing gets good at that point.
Yeah, one of them I'm working on now is a little depressing. Some of the words flowed a little bit too well. And I was like, am I in that dark of a place right now? Like, why is that going through my head?
Why does that resonate so much with the dark part of myself?
I did learn a lesson the other night. When you're working on a drama-type film, don't watch a film like Back to the Future while you're doing it.
That could be antithetical to what you're doing. So,
I ended up watching the entire trilogy the other night while trying to write.
Yeah.
And around 1 in the morning, I was like, why am I still awake watching Back to the Future? This has been very counterproductive.
Yeah. It's too fun of a movie.
Definitely is. Now, last but not least, you know, this novel that you've been working on.
Yeah.
You've actually shot me over a copy of that to start.
I did.
Start reading through some of that.
And I'm sorry for that. Some of the sentences are still very rough. So I actually got an agent reading it now, reading the first 50 pages, which I had to go back and like repolish because, as my girlfriend pointed out to me, it was 90% god-awful shit. So, yeah, I mean, we worked with it a little bit, so I polished it up, and I'm just kind of doing another repolishing now. But, yeah, it's kind of a cool concept. It's actually like this farce take on actually filming the Apogee. So it's kind of real life, but everything is exaggerated and skewed. So it's just, yeah, it's kind of a blatant comedy novel.
And what is the title of it again?
It's called Cinema Vino, at least right now. I mean, that could change in a year or two. It's kind of a bad title. Never been good at titling my movies, so.
Yeah, and I mean, novel writing, book writing in general, just tough.
You are in a completely different mindset when you're writing a novel. Like, I'm definitely more geared to writing screenplays, but it's been just, even if the novel doesn't go anywhere, it's been a tremendous exercise in just writing. Because as long as you're writing, you know, you're learning all the time. And kind of even as like Hemingway said, you know, even when he was writing at 60, you know, he never really did the same thing twice. He was always learning and moving towards something else. He was being a better writer. So you're always a different writer from like year to year. And so, yeah, just 9 months of that novel has really shown a lot about personally,
yeah, and it's always interesting too to see, you know, where you start and where you get as that finished product. Like, I know as we just finished the Miles on the Moon book, like seeing where, and granted, I mean, that's, it's just comedic essays. So it's like, I've had a few family members that have actually written regular books and they look at them and they're like, this is just crap. I'm like, well, yeah, you guys write a totally different, like,
yeah,
they're all serious different. And
yeah.
I'm like, yeah, Jordan and I, like, yeah, we're idiots. Like, we're having fun, enjoy it, laugh.
Right, yeah.
So it's like, yeah, Batman sexting, that's funny. Like, if Anthony Weiner can do it, so can Batman.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, sometimes, like, never, writing's not always, like, bad. Sometimes it just doesn't resonate with, like, a certain group. And so it's kind of hard doing that. But, yeah, I mean, I actually started reading your book, and I'm like, this is, you know, it's hilarious. It's great. Like, it kind of fits my, you know, type of genre I like, so.
Yeah, Jordan
really
and I had a laugh at how
audience.
Dark my side is compared to his.
Yeah.
we had to start calling that the dark side of the moon.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, it'll be kind of cool to dissect and go back and read through it and try to, like, figure out who's who and all that stuff, so.
So, well, before we wrap things up here, do you have anything that you want to kind of pitch, throw out there? Any particular place anybody can find any of the short films that you've done?
Vimeo. You can search like GSS Studios. That's three S's. So GSS and Studios. I think it's actually my page is vimeo.com/GSS Studios. Or you can just like search all the titles we kind of talked about here through them. I don't really go on YouTube much. I'm kind of a Vimeo guy. So it's all up there. People can also just like, you know, find me on Facebook. If they ever want to see any of my stuff, I'm actually pretty loose. I'll send them to DVDs of stuff I've done. That's cool. It's just kind of all online. As far as like pitching scripts and stuff, I have some managers, agencies interested right now, so won't tout any of those. I'll see what they say, if anything. So, yeah.
Cool. Well, good luck with it all, and thanks for, you know, taking the time out of all the writing and stuff you would be doing right now normally.
Oh, yeah. That's a good break. So.
Especially to come out right in the heart of Hollywood. Now that the marine layer is burned off, we've got a nice, nice sunny day out on a cloud, a few little teeny clouds.
Yeah, it's
pretty
nice
much not a cloud in the sky.
Yeah, it's, and the cool thing about California is, like, even though it's all this harsh sun, it still feels cool out. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, thanks for getting it together right in the heart of Hollywood.
Yeah, not a problem at all. So it's always good to get two Salt Lake guys that are in Hollywood trying to make shit happen.
This is us in our ascent to kind of pushing Hollywood forward. So we'll see where it'll be interesting to. Maybe we should come back in a few years and see where we're at.
Yeah, we'll be dressed up as some of the guys in front of the Chinese theater.
I'll be at the Starbucks down there. I'll be the guy in back you don't see making the coffee.
I've told people as I left that I was going to be Fat Spider-Man.
Yes. That would be amazing.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Glenn.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.